Welcome to Striving for Consensus, optimizing the selection and sequencing of therapy for patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this think tank-style program, I am joined by Dr. Carla Casullo from the Wilmot Cancer Institute in Rochester, New York, Dr. Laurie Sen from the BC Cancer Center for Lymphoid Cancer in Vancouver, Canada, and Dr. Matthew Matasar from the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey in New Brunswick, New Jersey. This is part two of our three-part series, and to begin, Dr. Casullo gives a presentation on CAR T-cell therapy in follicular lymphoma.
I'm going to talk about CAR T-cells in this setting, which are yet another option in the treatment armamentarium for follicular lymphoma. So the objectives, we're going to review some of the efficacy and safety from some pivotal CAR T trials using axicabtagene, tisagenlecleucel, and lysocabtagene in patients with relapsed follicular. We'll touch on the incidence and severity of CRS and some neurotoxicity, as well as some other late effects that have been emerging with CAR T cells. We'll try to touch on monitoring and toxicity management, recognizing that that's something that's actually done in the inpatient setting. And then we'll briefly discuss the impact of prior exposure and then some ongoing trials. So this is just a brief schematic just to kind of introduce the concept of CAR T cells. And I think most of us know that CAR T cells are generated from a patient's own T lymphocytes. They're genetically modified or transfected, typically with a gene that encodes a CAR to direct the patient's T cells against the lymphoma cells. And then they're genetically expanded and then infused back into the patient as therapy before which bridging therapy is administered. And then there's various different CAR T-cell constructs. They all have tiny differences amongst them, but they're all mostly directed against the same antigen, which is CD19, recognizing that a lot of these trials have not been compared head-to-head, so it's hard to make cross-trial comparisons. So as I mentioned, there are no head-to-head trials looking at the three approved CAR T-cell products in follicular lymphoma. As I mentioned, they have some subtle differences in the co-stimulatory domain. For example, 4-1BB is for T-cell and lysocell, and CD28 is for axi-cell. That can have an impact on some toxicity and the expansion of the different products. But the important thing to recognize is that those are really more of the kind of academic points, but all of these trials, all of these agents were approved based on phase two studies, which had around 100 patients, less so than what we have experienced with enlarged cell lymphoma, and they've all been approved for patients in the third line or later. So I think main point of this slide here is the overview of the response rate. And so what we can see here is that response rate is really outstanding for each product, ranging from 86% to 97%. Complete response rates are in the 70 to 90% range, and the duration of those deep responses appears very promising. The product that has the longest follow-up is axi-cel, and so we'll see later on that about 3/4 of patients will remain alive at 3 years. Similarly, outstanding survival with T-cell and lysocell, but with each product having a slightly different follow-up, we are going to be extrapolating and predicting the probability of duration of response over time. But just overall, really amazing outcomes, not too dissimilar with what we saw with bispecifics as well. So I'll begin with my first case. So this is a patient who was 68. He had follicular lymphoma diagnosed 6 years ago. He had bendamustine and rituximab, and then he had progression of disease from which he was symptomatic at the time. And he enrolled on a clinical trial that we had at our center using a PI3 kinase inhibitor and another novel drug. This was a 12-month treatment, so 12 cycles, and he ended up having a CR. But unfortunately developed recurrent disease 7 months later. He then received axi-cel, and that was complicated by grade 2 CRS and grade 1 ICANS. And then again, when we're talking about CRS, it's this inflammatory response that requires monitoring and different interventions. In the case of grade 2 CRS, that means that they were hypotensive and they were hypoxic as well. And then today, following axi-cel, he remains in CR. But he has had a course complicated by chronic cytopenias and hypogammaglobulinemia, for which he gets IVIG on a routine basis. Because of his cytopenias, he's had bone marrow evaluation, and it reveals a hypocellular marrow. but with trilineage hematopoiesis, no evidence of lymphoma and no evidence of MDS. But this is something that we do come across occasionally.
Let's go have a little feedback on the case, particularly the issue here of the CRS that happened and the grade one ICANS. Matt, as well as the cytopenias, hypogammaglobulinemia. Any thoughts and comments?
I would say that this is a patient that sort of had the expected and well-characterized toxicities of a very active treatment. And I'm sure that, you know, as we talk about CAR T with our patients, this is the discussions that we have. We are weighing these very well-characterized risks against the potential benefit of a very durable response for a one-time therapy. This patient had a suboptimal duration of response to BR and had a limited response durability to the second-line clinical trial. So I expect it was very attractive to hear from Dr. Kasulo that this treatment could lead to potentially very long-lasting remission.
So, Laurie, one of the issues that we've heard discussed for a long time now with CAR T has been the issue of having social support, family members, friends, et cetera. At one point, they needed to be in the hospital, out of the hospital, trying to pick up ICANS early. Where does that stand today? What do you look for? We actually had a patient presented who had no family, was homeless, et cetera. Somehow they managed to get him through CAR T with some additional help. But for practical purposes, what are you thinking about in terms of social assessment of these patients, Laurie?
Mm-hmm. I think it's still a really important part of the CAR T assessment process. So it's, it is a process. So this, although it's a one and done type of treatment, patients still need to come in for evaluation. They need to get leukapheresis. They then need to wait out the time for the cell product to be made. And once, you know, the cell product is ready and they get their chemo induction or lymphodepletion and the infusion back, many times that is still happening in the hospital setting. I know centers are different now. They're trying to create outpatient mechanisms, but that outpatient mechanism often requires them to stay in a facility right next to the cancer center or very close by, so many patients are actually moving to the cancer centers for a period of time, even if they're not being admitted for the whole time. And I think that is something that's very hard to do without social support. And, you know, the side effects that we want them to look out for include CRS and ICANS. And if you're a patient who starts to develop ICANS and you start to develop, delirium or change in mentation, you may not be the best person to pick that up. So that's, I think, probably one of the most important reasons why they need to have somebody looking after them to pick up early signs of some of these really critical toxicities that need to be acted on in real time.
Mm-hmm. Carla, anything you want to add to that? And also, what comes first, bispecific or CAR T?
That's a good question. I will add to first the concept of the social support. That is absolutely imperative. And this is a situation where the social history is just as important as a medical history, because patients, in fact, the FDA mandates that patients have to live close to the hospital for a period of time in order to monitor for late ICANS, and they can't drive, which is very relevant, particularly in rural settings. So I think that that's the social component is absolutely pivotal. With regards to sequencing CAR T-cell and bispecific, it's really a tough choice, and it depends on sort of the individual's tolerance for toxicity early versus late, whether someone wants to explore bispecifics first, and then if they have something in their back pocket if they relapse later and have CAR T. But I think that for patients that are young, have very rapidly progressive disease, possibly PA24, if you're concerned for transformation, I think CAR T-cell therapy makes a lot of sense to me in that setting. But we don't have any data to tell us which one is better than the other, first or second.
Matt, in terms of clinical practice, a lot of these patients got treated when these agents were experimental, get them on trials, but now we have approved options here. Or how are you thinking about it at a sort of a granular level, Matt? Which comes first?
Yeah, it really comes down to, and I think it was Carla said this before, this shared decision-making approach, right? Where we know that we have two very powerful tools, and one of them will feel more right for a patient. Some patients really like the idea of intermittent outpatient therapy. It's very familiar to them. It reminds them of their earlier lines of treatment. Some patients may have been on a trial where they were coming in all the time and they're fed up with my waiting room or with the front desk staff, and they just don't want any more of that, and they'd much rather just get a single hospital-based treatment. And we can tell patients that they're both very powerfully effective and meet them where they're at.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we just saw a patient who got AxiCell. Let's talk a little bit about the data.
Sure. So AxiCell was approved based on the Zuma 5 trial. And this is the schema. This is the study design. So you see that patients were included if they had relapsed or refractory indolent NHL. So not just follicular lymphoma, but also marginal zone lymphoma, be it either nodal or extranodal, although the indication is not in marginal zone yet, hopefully, but not quite. Patients had to have two or more prior lines of therapy that included having had a monoclonal antibody against CD20 with an alkylator, so either bendamustine or an anthracycline. They then underwent leukapheresis, and then for AxiCell, they had lymphodepleting chemotherapy with fludarabine or cyclophosphamide. Those are the two standard lymphodepleting treatments that are used, but there are others. And then bridging therapy was not permitted. They then had their infusion and then their post-treatment assessment. And the primary endpoint was overall response rate. So I think that what this is showing us here is that the overall response rate in all patients was very high, 90% overall response rate. And then in the follicular cohort, it was higher than in the marginal zone cohort, overall response rate of 94% with a CR of 79%. And the median time from the median follow from leukapheresis was a little over 60 months. So this kind of tells you that the response rate is really quite favorable. Here's the progression-free survival. This was long-term follow-up that was presented at ASH. Overall, in all patients, median progression-free survival was 62 months with a 60-month progression-free survival of 50% with in follicular lymphoma. So again, very durable. And I think that you could see here that it's the marginal zone lymphoma cohort. Again, there's fewer patients, but it seemingly may be a little bit of a plateau there, but it's hard to say. The duration of response, again, was also quite favorable. Estimated duration of response at 60 months was 53%. In most patients, the response was ongoing. But as I mentioned earlier, among patients who received a complete response, more of them remained with a durable response, and the median time to next treatment was not reached. This here is showing us a little bit of the long-term safety effect. And what you can see here, this was, again, the updated results from ASH, but there were really no new safety signals in the five-year follow-up compared to what the earlier studies reported. And what you can see here is that as you go on to 5 years post-AxiCell infusion, you see very little progressive disease at years 4 and 5. You see very little non-relapsed mortality. You could see here that 2 deaths were from unknown causes. 1 was from CRS. And interestingly, there were no T-cell malignancies, which is something that's emerging as a concern with some CAR T-cells. So I think that what this tells us is that the farther out someone gets from their treatment, then it appears that the toxicities will start to diminish and the risk of death will also be lower.
Before you go to your next case, can you just update us on what we know in general about second cancers with CAR T, including AxiCell?
Yeah, so the risk of secondary malignancies is real. I think with any of these treatments, particularly given the lymphodepleting chemotherapy being an additive component, and then the prior treatment that patients have received, I think it stands to reason that there's a higher likelihood of having malignancies with these treatments. It seems like there's recent data suggesting that the vector, the T cell, the vector that's used to create the new chimeric antigen receptor, has been implicated in some cases of T cell malignancies later on. This is in a small proportion of patients, but I think it's something that certainly we're all have on our radar and something that we're being very attentive to.
Matt, any comments about second cancers, particularly T cell malignancies? I've heard people speculate that maybe these are just being uncovered, but on the other hand, maybe the mechanism that Carla just talked about with the vector.
Yeah, I mean the phenomenon of second primary malignancies for patients diagnosed with lymphoma has been well understood. We know that patients diagnosed with lymphoma are at risk for a myriad range of other malignancies, either related to underlying immunodeficiency or therapeutic exposures. I think that the purported T-cell lymphoma risks with CAR T-cell therapy, it made a big splash in the press, particularly the lay press. I think that these are numerically extremely uncommon events. And for patients that were entertaining the use of CAR T-cell therapy, I would suggest that the risks of disease for which we're treating with CAR T-cell therapy vastly overwhelm the very small risk of this rare consequence.
All right, well, let's go on to your next case, a 64-year-old man with COPD and hypertension.
Yes, so he was also treated with VR for low-grade follicular lymphoma, high tumor burden. He had a little bit less than the expected duration, about average. 4 years later, he had a low tumor burden recurrence, but he was observed at the time, which I think is appropriate given that he didn't meet any indication for treatment. 1 year later, though, he developed progressive inguinal lymphadenopathy and really bothersome lower extremity edema and some night sweats. And then he began lenalidomide with rituximab, but he had a tricky rash and really was not tolerant of any modifications or dose delays. So we ended after 7 cycles, after which he had documented a partial response. And then 4 months later, developed cervical lymphadenopathy and dyspnea. And similar to what the case we heard earlier, some pleural effusions, and a biopsy of a cervical lymph node showed grade 2 follicular lymphoma. So he received T-cell gemcitabine. He had a complete response at his 30-day assessment. He did not have any CRS or any ICANS, and he continues to do well today.
So, Laurie, any thoughts or comments about this case?
Yeah, no, I would highlight that this is a gentleman with comorbidity. So despite the fact that he's only 64, he is somebody I would worry about a little bit in terms of the toxicity of anything that I would be giving him. I think at that point, it doesn't sound like there's any concern for transformation. So you believe you're treating follicular lymphoma, you need to move on to something else. This is the kind of patient I probably had considered a bispecific antibody in more than a CAR T product just because of his comorbidities, but seems like he did really well. But I think these are the discussions that have to be had with these patients. And you know, you asked, which one do you prefer? I think for the most part, to me, CAR T-cell therapy still comes with more intensity and more concern for real toxicities, such as the prolonged cytopenias that we mentioned in another case. So I do think of it as a more intensive treatment than bispecific. So probably this is a patient I might have preferred a bispecific first, because it's already been mentioned, it doesn't take the other option off the table. It's just mm-hmm. a matter of what order you might sequence it in. And I think for all of the treatments we select, it's always a risk-benefit ratio. Here, I would say the risk would have concerned me a little bit.
I totally agree with you. We had this conversation, and to the point that we heard earlier, he really wanted something that was a one-time. So he lives far from the cancer center. He has a very active life with a situation at home where he needs to be there for a number of other family members. And he said, I really need something that I'm not coming a lot to the hospital. And this was the choice that was made on the basis of that. But I had similar concerns regarding his underlying comorbidities, which, fortunately did not complicate his treatment. But I share completely your position.
Matt, any thoughts? And also within the available CAR T products, if you have a patient with comorbidities or someone who wants to minimize side effects and toxicity, how do you choose between the three?
Yep, that's exactly where I was going to go with this. You can see that Carla tipped her hat a little bit with the choice of T-cell. You've heard that we have this range of CAR T products that are approved for patients with relapsed indolent disease, but we think of T-cell as our gentlest choice. The lowest rates of high-grade CRS and ICANS. It's perhaps a little bit less active, perhaps, in indolent disease. But because we don't think of these agents as yet having established curative potential, the idea of administering our safest and gentlest of the CAR T products for this gentleman with comorbidities, I think, was a very thoughtful choice.
All right, well, let's talk about the data.
All right. So TSGN Lifluzil was approved based on the ALARA study. So just going through the study design. So this included patients who are 18 or older who had only follicular lymphoma here, grade 1, 2, or 3A, without any evidence of transformation and no prior CD19-directed therapy, which likely most patients would not have been exposed to. In this trial, you'll notice that there is an option of bridging chemotherapy, which some trials permit, and that is essentially permitting someone to have some in-between treatment to address any disease that's rapidly progressing until they get their CAR T-cell product. Then they had their lymphodepleting chemotherapy and then their efficacy assessment. Here, the lymphodepleting chemotherapy was fludarabine and cyclophosphamide or bendamustine, which is a little different from axi-cel. And then the primary endpoint was complete response rate. The other thing to mention, actually, as before I forget, as Dr. Matizar said, is that the toxicity of TSGN is a little gentler. And because of that reason, about 20% of patients on the pivotal trial were permitted to get this as an outpatient. We've not adopted that at our institution really routinely in select cases we have, but that is another consideration for this particular product. So here the median follow-up was 17 months, overall response rate was 86%, complete response rate a little lower at 69%, but two-year PFS follow-up is still a little bit short, but was 57%. And even in patients who had initial partial response, some of them went on to get a complete response. This here highlights some specific outcomes in the high-risk group of patients that was published recently. There was a good proportion of patients with POD24, high metabolic tumor burden, which remains really a research question that has not been established as a kind of something that we would use in standard practice. But other things like having bulky disease and having double refractory status, all those patients really, it did not seem to affect their outcome overall. And the complete response rates were still, I would say, relatively high. Here is the updated progression-free survival from the abstract that was presented at ASH. And you could see here that the 24-month PFS was 82%. And as you could see here, in patients that are in CR, it was a lot longer compared to the patients that were in PR, which, again, I think, as we have heard, is a recurring theme. Similarly, time to next treatment was also very good, particularly for patients in CR looks like it was about 10 months for patients in PR. So again, really just underscoring the fact that patients that do best with CAR T-cell therapy, not just CAR T, but also bispecifics, the deeper the response, the better, the longer it is. Our next case is a 48-year-old woman who had obesity, arthritis, and asthma. She was diagnosed with low-grade FL, also treated with BR. Shortly thereafter, she had progressive high tumor burden, symptomatic disease, biopsy-proven follicular lymphoma. She started on obinutuzumab with CHOP. She unfortunately relapsed less than 1 year later with inguinal adenopathy, also lower extremity edema and B symptoms, and she was treated with mosunetuzumab. She had a partial response and then went on to receive liso-cel with a complete response at 30 days. She had a complication of grade 1 CRS but no ICANS, and today she remains in a complete response.
So, Matt, any comments about this case? Also, I'm kind of sort of getting a little bit of a picture of a patient who maybe has maybe more comorbidities than the average patient. Any comments about these specific issues?
It's an interesting case presentation because we don't have a lot of published experience yet for this sequence of bispecific before CAR, but I think that we're going to all collectively gain greater experience with this, particularly in light of trials moving bispecifics into earlier lines of therapy. So I'm encouraged by how CAR-less patient did with the liso-cel after an apparent failure of mosun. I'm interested to hear more about the PR. This was a patient who had a partial response at the end of 17 cycles and you thought was persistent disease, or you interrupted therapy because of a slow response and consolidated with the CAR.
Yeah, that was really more like it because of the fact that she's young, she had POD24, she had very rapidly progressive disease, but you could theoretically have continued her on mosunetuzumab, but there was a concern that we needed to move on to something faster, and she still was quite symptomatic, so that was the decision-making there.
And Laurie, just curious also about the issue of bridging therapy to CAR. Would you ever use a bispecific to bridge?
You know, it's funny. I think the topic comes up less often in the context of follicular lymphoma because most of these patients aren't having such accelerated disease necessarily that you need to do something quickly. So once the decision is to move on to a CAR, I'd have to say most of the patients don't actually need a bridge. That becomes much more relevant in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma where you sometimes have rapidly evolving aggressive disease and you really need to buy them time to get them to the infusion. I personally, you know, we don't have a lot of data on using bispecifics in that scenario. I think we'll be seeing that emerge probably through real world data and some clinical trials that are ongoing on, particularly in the large B-cell lymphoma setting. As you know, there is a ramp up required for bispecific. So, you know, you don't get the impact and the punch right away. So that in some ways makes them not ideal if you're looking for rapid benefit. But, you know, in a patient that has evolving disease, you don't have other options. I know they are being used, and I think we'll see more data on that. It becomes less relevant for follicular lymphoma.
That's a great point. Okay, Carla, how about liso-cel?
Well, liso-cel is our third CAR T-cell product, and I want to just take you through the TRANSCEND study, which was the study that led to the approval of liso-cel. So just to bring your attention to the fact that this is a slightly different population. It was second line plus. And in addition to that, had a cohort of patients that they called high risk, where they could have received the liso-cel as a second line therapy. And they deemed that as the high risk patients who were either POD24 or who had GELF criteria for therapy. And so patients, it just kind of tells you, goes down the line here, how many patients were leukapheresed, how many patients ended up being treated, and how many of them ended up in their efficacy set, but really just wanted to highlight that there was slightly two distinct populations here. The overall response rate with liso-cel was divided up based on the line of therapy. So for patients who had three or in whom this was given as third line or above, the overall response rate was 97%, CR of 94%. But even for patients that got it as a second line, they still had very, very excellent outcomes. Again, I think just underscoring its efficacy in a high-risk cohort of patients. Similarly, here you can see that the duration of response is quite good. The 12-month PFS was about 81%. And then the updated analysis suggested that at 24 months, it was around 82%. For patients who got it in the third line, it seemed to be slightly lower at 72%. But overall, it sort of highlights that maybe if you give it a little earlier, patients do a little bit better. And then kind of transitioning a little bit to some of the toxicities of special interest that we have been alluding to, them being primarily cytokine release syndrome and immune effector cell neurotoxicity, which is known as ICANS. And again, CRS is this systemic inflammatory response characterized by fever and hypotension. You can have end organ dysfunction. It could look very much like sepsis. And then in neurotoxicity, it could be lethargy. It could be confusion. It could be, even in some very severe cases, cerebral edema. But we don't see that severe toxicity with some of these products. And as it was alluded to earlier, axi-cel seems to have a higher rate of CRS compared to some of the other agents, recognizing that there is no side-by-side cross-trial comparison. Similarly, the rates of ICANS were higher, and then T-cell having the lowest rate of severe grade 3, along with liso-cel having the lower rate of severe toxicity of both CRS and ICANS. Infections, again, seemingly slightly higher, more represented with axi-cel. Not an insignificant amount of grade 3 infections with the other products, and then this is the requirement for tocilizumab on each trial, recognizing though that these are toxicities that will be managed as an inpatient, given very standard operating procedures that all of our hospitals have now for this. Just wanted to allude to what are some of the grading for CRS, which is now based on the ASCT guidelines. They're all graded on a scale of 1 to 4, depending on how life-threatening they are. If the symptoms are mild or moderate, whether there's hypotension only, whether there's a need for vasopressor support or intubation or anything like that. And then this is another criteria called the Penn criteria. But overall, we have this very robust criteria that helps us understand whether to use steroids, whether to use tocilizumab, whether to have just fluid. So there's lots of different ways that this is done. But again, it's primarily in the inpatient setting. Same thing for neurotoxicity, which is also based on this consensus grading. We have an ICE score where patients are asked a series of questions for orientation, naming, they have to write a sentence to help, they have to have demonstrate good executive function. And this is assessed on a daily basis. The toxicity is graded in this manner, and then patients typically are given steroids. Often CRS happens first and then ICANS happens later. And so those are things that we monitor for on the inpatient setting as well. And these are some of the things that we have to look for when a patient goes home. In terms of some possible sequencing considerations, as we talked about earlier, there's very limited data in follicular lymphoma, but in large cell lymphoma, there was a study that was published recently demonstrating that patients who received bendamustine prior to their apheresis for CAR T cells seem to have lower response rates, progression-free survival, and even overall response rate compared to the cohort of patients without bendamustine exposure. And this also translated into a concern for a higher risk of progression or death, kind of calling into question whether or not bendamustine should be used as bridging therapy for patients in whom CAR T-cell is being considered. But again, recognizing this is an extrapolation, we don't have data in follicular lymphoma that I'm aware of. And then just to quickly end on some of the ongoing trials in CAR T-cell. So again, as we discussed, a lot of these trials have evaluated patients in the third line or later. And now some of the newer iterations of studies are looking at a randomized setting and in earlier lines of therapy. So ZUMA-22 is comparing standard of care compared to axi-cel in relapsed refractory follicular, including a cohort of patients with POD24. The LETA trial is looking at tisagenlecleucel compared to standard of care with slightly different investigator choice options. And then similarly, lysocell is being looked at in second line therapy in the high-risk cohort.
I would like your thoughts on the issue, Matt, on when do you think a doc in community-based practice should start thinking about sending a patient to a tertiary center with follicular lymphoma, particularly to consider CAR-T, but maybe even for advice on CAR-T versus bispecific?
It's a great question, Neil. And my personal take and my bias is that we serve our patients best when we're in really close collaboration throughout the patient journey. So I would much rather talk to my community oncologist that I partner with before starting first-line therapy, just so that we have a sense for where the patient's at. We are all running clinical trials that may be relevant and attractive options for patients across the follicular lymphoma journey. So finding ways to break down the barriers between community oncologists who see the vast majority of these patients in America, and I'm sure Canada as well, to try to lower those barriers and to try to improve collaboration between academic and community oncologists so that we can collaborate in best service of our patients. For me, that's the gold standard.
I got to say, you surprised me there, but it makes a lot of sense. I don't know how practical it is, but that's a really interesting thought. Laurie, any thoughts about when is an ideal time and when really is it important to send a patient in, or at least talk to a tertiary care center?
Yeah, so I would echo Matt's comments in that clinical trials are a real opportunity for patients, and those are happening across the spectrum of management, so frontline and beyond. But I think that, probably short of seeing a patient right away, I think most people feel fairly comfortable with what standard frontline therapy is right now. And right now, it still is chemoimmunotherapy, and patients get long benefit from that. Second line, I think there are options opening up, but I think most people feel comfortable that lenalidomide rituximab is probably firmly there as a preferred option. It's when it comes to third line that I think things become a little bit more confusing. We're going to talk in a minute about the other options that go beyond bispecifics and CAR-T, which are also adding complexity to the choices. But I think that's when you really need to match the available treatments up with the patient in front of you. Some of the consideration depends on, what the disease behavior is, and the other consideration depends on who the patient is, what their comorbidities are, what their preferences are in terms of treatment and inconvenience or convenience. So I think there's a lot of discussion in the third line setting, and for community doctors to have the support of somebody in an academic center who maybe spends most of their time thinking about these options, I think is very valuable.
So Carla, I'd like your thoughts on this as well. And also, in terms of first line trials, what are some of the trial concepts that you think would be most exciting for a patient or community doc to think about?
Yeah, I think that the trials, based on what we heard recently at ASH, there's a lot of excitement about using these treatments in earlier lines. And that's mostly how we develop these drugs and how the sequencing question is answered. Is it better to use it in the first line? And how does that impact on your treatment in the second and subsequent line? So I think that that, to me, is a very exciting space. And then with regards to the decision of CAR-T versus bispecific, this is really an ongoing debate, I think, in the lymphoma community. It's hard to know exactly what the best choice is. It's so patient-dependent. Comorbidities, the desire for something that's more fixed versus something that's longer term. I think we don't really know whether these drugs are curing anyone. And so sometimes, because the data is more mature with bispecifics, for someone in whom you're very concerned, that's young and can tolerate the toxicity, that may seem a more appealing choice. But you really do have to think of each person individually and kind of decide together with them and their local oncologist what kind of support they have. All of that those are important things to think about.
Yeah, I mean, thinking back of my teclistamab patient, I think the things that are really interesting is when you have exciting therapies that you can only get on a trial. To me, the idea of having a bispecific, for example, integrated into your first line therapy, that sounds exciting, really exciting. Right. But you don't see that every day. So often it's sort of existing treatments being moved around, et cetera. But here you'll get a therapy that you're not going to get in clinical practice. This concludes our program, and be on the lookout for the other two parts of this program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of Relapsed Refractory Follicular Lymphoma.